As you see on the screen, we're going to be studying from Numbers chapter 21 this evening. That'll be our text for the night. And we're going to be looking at verses 4 through 9. And I'm sure this is a passage that is familiar to most of us and probably one that we have studied on numerous occasions. But it's one of those passages in the Bible that I think is just full of rich lessons and many things and many directions we could go. Then they set out from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom. And the people became impatient because of the journey. And the people spoke against God and Moses, "Why have you brought us out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and we loathe this miserable food." And the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, so that many people of Israel died. So the people came to Moses and said, "We have sinned because we have spoken against the Lord and you. Intercede with the Lord that he may remove the serpents from us." And Moses interceded for the people. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Make a fiery serpent and set it on a standard, and it shall come about that everyone who is bitten, when he looks at it, he shall live." And Moses made a bronze serpent and set it on the standard, and it came about that if a serpent bit any man, when he looked to the bronze serpent, he lived. Now, in order for us to fully appreciate what is taking place here, we need to take just a minute to understand the historical context of these events. The first thing I would look at is the context of their sin, as I've called it, the historical context of these events. In the preceding chapter, we're told that Aaron has just died on Mount Hor, and that Israel has mourned him for 30 days. And why this is important is it lets us know specifically where we are in the history of the children of Israel. It says, and we look over at Numbers 33, verse 38, it says, "Then Aaron the priest went up to Mount Hor at the command of the Lord and died there in the 40th year after the sons of Israel had come from the land of Egypt on the first day in the fifth month." So what we're told here is this is the 40th year of the wandering in the wilderness. Think about that. So that tells us that this puts the children of Israel on the precipice of this 40 years of wandering. And they're just about to enter the promised land. Here is a map of the Middle East there, and you see that the V shape there on the right flank there is the northern tip of the Red Sea, and up above that is the Dead Sea or the Sea of Salt. And this red circle kind of shows where the children of Israel are, right there. That's as far as we can tell. That's where they are at this time. And right up at the tip of the Dead Sea is where Jericho is. So they're not too far from where they need to go. But right now, they're kind of in the territory of Edom, which I have circled here. And if you read in the previous chapter, what happens is the Edomites say, "You can't cross through our land. We're not going to let you cross through our land to get over to Jericho." I think for some reason, I cannot figure out why they did not go up on the western side there. Maybe because it was just, the terrain or the desert or whatever. But so what they have to do is they have to go down to the northern end of the Red Sea, and the little circle follows this little trail here, and go all the way around Edom back up to Jericho to where they're going. So here they are, just about to enter the promised land, and the Edomites say, "You can't come through our land." That's about 200 miles out of the way. So when it says here that the people became impatient because of the journey, it's not just saying they're tired of wandering in the wilderness, which I think is probably the case. What it's saying is that they all of a sudden are right there, ready to, it seems, take possession of the promised land, and now they've got to go back about 200 miles out of the way to go around Edom to get where they're going. So that's what I think it means there. And another thing I think we need to recognize that's probably, in our minds, just based on the time frame, is that these events are not happening to those who were unfaithful in the wilderness and did not take possession of the promised land when God first commanded. This is the next generation. This is the generation that God promised would receive the land after the wandering in the wilderness. Look at the next passage we have here. This is Deuteronomy 2 and verse 14. Now the time that it took for us to come from Kadesh Barnea until we crossed over the brook Zered was 38 years until all the generation of the men of war perished from within the camp as the Lord had sworn to them. So this is happening after that generation is gone. These are those who are opted or selected to possess the land. And now all of a sudden, you know, everything's changed for them. They've got to go the other direction. So that's the context of what's going on here, what I'm calling the context of their sin. The next thing I'd like to look at is what I'm calling the cause of their sin. And we'll look at that in Numbers 21, 4 through 5. And I think we've touched on this a little bit, but let's bring this verse up and read it. It says, then they set out from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the people became impatient because of the journey. And we'll stop reading right there for right now. In studying this, I don't think that is the best translation of how they felt. If you read in verse 5 there, it looks like it appears that they think they're even going to die in the wilderness. I don't think they should be thinking that, but that's what they're saying. The King James, I think, translates it a little bit better. And it says that the soul of the people was much discouraged because of the way. That's a little bit different than impatient. Impatient is how I feel when I'm in the drive-thru and the person in front of me changes their order at the window. That's impatient. And that's one of those things. I'm in a hurry and they're taking a lot longer than they should. It's supposed to be 3 minutes. You're supposed to be in line at the drive-thru. And I always count. No, I'm just kidding. But that's what impatient is. And I think the New American Standard Version, I think that's an unfortunate translation. I don't think impatient is what they really felt. My understanding from what I've read is that the word translating became impatient or souls became discouraged. It's the only time this phrase is used in the Bible. It's actually a Hebrew idiom of two separate words. And the first word is the Hebrew word katsar, and it means to reap or harvest. And the second word is the Hebrew word nefesh. I'm not a Hebrew scholar, and it means soul or life. And what we might be told here, what might be being said, is that they literally had their souls harvested. The wind taken out of their sails. Think about it. And I think, you know, we can all, you know, kind of relate to how they must have felt. Have you ever anticipated something, maybe for a long time, and you're there and you're about to have it take place, and then it doesn't happen? And we know people who have had the rugs pulled out from under them by tragedy, and their lives have been completely turned upside down overnight. And I can't help but think of the Smeltzer family who just lost their young son to drowning and what they must feel. And I think when we look at it from this perspective and see the context of what's going on, we might have a little bit more understanding of what the children of Israel are going through. They're not just impatient. They've just been sorely disappointed and their hopes derailed. And you know, from their perspective, things are not going well at all. So I think we can all relate to that. If that's but what's being said about how they feel, I think we can understand that discouragement and that disheartenment and maybe even, you know, accept that part of it. And I don't think God would even fault them for feeling that way. What they did wrong here, though, was rather than accepting the situation and trusting in God, they murmured against him. And that we'll look at that in 21:5 here. And the people spoke against God and Moses. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? And maybe they were actually thinking that. For there is no food and no water, and we loathe this miserable food. Now they're contradicting themselves a little bit there, aren't they? There's no food, and we hate the food we have. So there's food, they just don't like it. They loathe it. And they're rebelling against God. And I think that we've known people who, when things don't go the way they want them to, what do? They blame God. They point their finger at Him. You did this to me. And that seems to me what they're basically saying here is that they're blaming God. And somebody might say, you know, well, you really need to cut them some slack because this was just a really difficult thing. We need to remember what these people witnessed on a daily basis. And I've got some passages here to look at. Numbers chapter 14, verse 11. And this is actually when they were told to take possession of the promised land the first time. But you've got to remember that many people who were here at this time witnessed this. You know, there were probably some teenagers and older young people that witnessed this. And I'm sure they heard the other people tell about it. But here's what the Lord said. He said, "And the Lord said to Moses, how long will this people spurn me? And how long will they not believe in me despite all the signs which I have performed in their midst?" See, that was God's problem back then, wasn't it? And what had He just done in Egypt? He had just parted the Red Sea, and He says, "You can take these people." And they saw all those signs, and they said, "We can't do it." They weren't looking to God. They were looking to themselves. Look what He says later on in the chapter. "Surely all the men who have seen my glory and my signs, which I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness, yet have put me to the test these 10 times and have not listened to my voice, shall by no means see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who spurned me see it." Now these are spurning God here in this location. Some of them are, aren't they? But this is when they were first to take possession of the land. Look what it says in Nehemiah about the generation we're discussing right now. "Thou in thy great compassion did not forsake them in the wilderness. The pillar of cloud did not leave them by day to guide them on their way, nor the pillar of fire by night to light for them the way in which they were to go. And thou didst give thy good spirit to instruct them. Thy manna thou didst not withhold from their mouth, and thou didst give them water for their thirst. Indeed, 40 years thou didst provide for them in the wilderness, and they were not in want. Their clothes did not wear out, nor did their feet swell." These people saw the cloud, the pillar of cloud, every day, and the pillar of fire. They got up every morning, except for Saturday, and gathered manna that just appeared on the ground. And they saw what happened in Egypt, or at least heard about it. They saw evidence of God every day. And now this little hiccup comes, and what do? They said, "You're going to let us die." That was not what God was going to do. You know, and somebody might say, you know, well, why does God even allow this to happen to them? It's just not fair that God allowed this to happen. Well, for one thing, life isn't fair, and especially a life in a sinful world. This is a quote from Alistair Begg. I heard this on the radio the other day. He's a preacher, radio preacher, has a lot of good things to say. I don't agree with everything he says, but this really struck me, especially in light of the sermon I was preparing. We must put what we feel in subjection to what we know. These people didn't do that, did they? They saw God on a daily basis. They knew He cared for them. They knew He provided for them. But they were feeling discouraged because things didn't go well, and they didn't put that feeling or those feelings in subjection to what they knew about God. And likewise, we need to do the same with the God who takes care of us. These people were delivered from bondage. God provided for them daily, and He has done the same for us, hasn't He? He's delivered us from the bondage of sin. He provides for our needs, both physically and spiritually. And He has promised us a promised land if we will just be faithful. Now why God did this. "And you shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness these 40 years, that He might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep His commandments or not. And He humbled you and let you be hungry, and fed you with manna which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you understand that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. Your clothing did not wear out on you, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. And what he's saying here is that I allowed these things to happen to you to test you, to prove you, so that you would trust in me and know that it is I who sustains you. That you don't have to worry about the Edomites or anybody else who comes along. I will take care of you. And you know, the thing is, the Edomites are the ones who did this when you really think of it. It wasn't God. God gave the Edomites free will. He also made them a promise that he would not take their land from them. They're the ones who did not allow the children of Israel to pass through their territory. But here they are blaming God because things aren't going the way they want to. And he said he did this to test them. Well, on this occasion, they clearly failed the test, didn't they? They had murmured against the very God who delivered them from bondage and cared for them these 40 years in the wilderness. Next, we have what I would call the consequences of their sin. Look at verse 6 of Numbers 21. And the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people so that many people of Israel died. And commentators speculate on whether the serpents are called fiery because of their color or because of their sting. And I think the answer to that is yes. It seems to me it's both. Because they did apparently have a very fiery sting, and Moses made a serpent of bronze, we will see in a minute. But God sent these serpents among the camp, and we're told that many people of Israel died. I don't know how many is, but it's certainly more than just a few. And it's enough to where it got their attention, isn't it? Very seriously got their attention. Why did God send the serpents among them? Why do you think he did that? Why did he send the serpents among the camp? Was he just being vindictive or punishing them and just saying, you didn't listen to me, now you're going to suffer? Is that what God was doing? I think we all know that's not the God that we serve. It's not the God of the Bible. And what God was doing is he sent the serpents among them to discipline them, to instruct them. What did God want from the people here? When you analyze it and look at it from the big picture, what did he really want? He wanted them to have faith in him. That's what he wanted. He wanted them to trust in him no matter what happened. And that's the lesson he was trying to teach them all along in the wilderness. That you need to have faith in me, that whatever comes about, you can trust me. As Les said, all options are open to God this morning. I thought that was a great statement. But that's the case, isn't it? They don't need to worry about the Edomites. God said, I'm going to give you this land. And he meant it, didn't he? He wanted them to have faith. And it didn't matter who stood in their way, what nation, what person, what people. He was going to honor his promise if they would simply trust in him. You know, the New Testament comments on this. This very passage in 1 Corinthians 10:9, and the lesson is for us too. Nor let us try the Lord as some of them did and were destroyed by the serpents, nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the age have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. And these people may have thought, hey, we're not like our fathers. We're getting the land. We would certainly take it. Seems like they thought they would stand there when they didn't. But let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he would fall. No temptation has overtaken you but such as is common to man. And God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also, that you may be able to endure it. Isn't God saying the same thing to us as he's saying to them? And that he wants the same thing from us. He wants us to trust him. No matter what we face, no matter what comes our way, what he wants from us is to trust him, because he has promised us that nothing is going to come at us that we cannot handle. He will not allow that. And we need to take that to our hearts, no matter what's going on in our lives. It may not be easy. We may get disheartened. We may get discouraged. But we serve a God for whom all options are open. I'm going to keep using that list. I think that's an excellent way to express it. But God sent these serpents into the camp to bring the sin they'd committed to their attention and let them know the seriousness of their offense. He wasn't being vindictive. He was trying to get their attention and get them to realize what they had done. And it's clear that that's exactly the effect the serpents had on the people. So the people came to Moses and said, "We have sinned because we have spoken against the Lord, and you intercede with the Lord that he may remove the serpents from us." And Moses interceded for the people. The people had already sinned before the serpents were introduced, hadn't they? But now they recognize their sin. And it was only then, after people were being bit and dying, that they fully recognized their sin and sought God's mercy. And I think it's interesting to note what the people asked here. They asked God to remove the serpents. And one of the first things that came to my mind when I began studying this passage is, why didn't God remove the serpents? Why didn't he just take away the serpents? That would have solved the problem. But I think that there was a lesson to be learned for them, and I think there's also some lessons to be learned for us, is why God did not do that. First of all, the people aren't asking God to take away their sin, are they? They're asking him to take away the consequences of their sin. And there's a big difference between those two things. You know, there are Christians who have become Christians while in prison after committing serious offenses. They are in prison because of the consequence of their sins. Does becoming a Christian change that for them? Not by any means. They still have to suffer those consequences. God is merciful, and he forgives the sin, but he cannot always and does not remove the consequences. That's just natural cause and effect relationship. We do things. We sin, and we have consequences that we have to accept. I have a scar on my finger right here. This isn't a sin, but when I was 5 years old, this is about a one-inch scar, I decided I was going to make a spear out of a broken knife and a broomstick. Didn't go very well. And I sliced my finger open, and 45 years later, I have the scar here. The pain is gone, but the scar is still there. And sometimes sin brings scars, doesn't it? And sometimes those scars are still painful. Sometimes those scars never go away. That's the consequence of sin. But God, in his mercy, forgives the sin, but he does not remove the consequence. But I think there's another lesson here as well. And that's that I think the serpents are intended to represent something. And I'll just bear with me here for a couple moments. And some commentators say that what the serpents represent is sin. And though I think that's part of it, I don't think that's completely accurate. We just spoke about this, but what purpose did the serpent serve here? They brought the sin the people committed to the people's attention. They made them aware of their sin, didn't they? It seems to me that's what they did. When God introduced the serpents into the camp, what the serpents did is they brought the realization, the knowledge to the people that they had sinned. Up prior to that point, it doesn't appear they had any repentance or any change of heart. But as soon as they started suffering the consequences and seeing what they had done as a result of God introducing these serpents, then they recognized their sin. You know, according to the Apostle Paul, that is the very purpose the law serves. is that it causes us to recognize our sin. And this is a lengthy reading, but I think it's well worth it. And we could look at a number of passages in Romans or Galatians. I chose this one because I think it just says it so clearly. If we follow this, it makes such good sense. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? May it never be. On the contrary, I would not have come to know sin except through the law. For I would not have known about coveting if the law had not said, you shall not covet. But sin taking opportunity through the commandment produced in me coveting of every kind. And Paul's not saying that the commandment made him covet. The coveting was there, but it wasn't until he read the law that said, thou shalt not covet, that he realized he was guilty of coveting. For apart from the law, sin is dead, and I was once alive apart from the law, but when the commandment came, sin became alive, and I died. And this commandment, which was to result in life, why was the commandment to result in life? Because if we kept it perfectly, it would produce life in us. The commandment that was created and intended to provide life resulted in death for me, for sin taking opportunity through the commandment deceived me, and through it killed me. And what Paul is saying is that when he held himself up to God's law, if he hadn't looked at it, he wouldn't have recognized the sin in his life. But when he held himself up to it, he realized that he was lacking, and just like the children of Israel, in need of mercy. That the commandment killed him because he realized the poison in his life. And what does it say in 1 Corinthians 15:56? The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. And I'm not sure that is not a reference somehow to this passage in Numbers, the way that is worded, that the sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. So I'm suggesting here that the serpents represent the law. The law was intended to give life. But when we hold ourselves up to it, we see that we are poisoned by sin. It makes us aware of our sin, and all have sinned, according to Romans 3:23, and fall short of the glory of God. The children of Israel were bit by these serpents, and they were dying. Left and right, apparently, many people of Israel died. And when they recognized that, they came to Moses and said, intercede for us, please. We've sinned. Take the serpents away. They could be saying, take the sin away, in a sense. And that may be where the serpents do represent sin. But God doesn't do that. And we're dying also, aren't we? Because we have been stung by sin. And we see that through the law. But God didn't leave it at that. He provided a cure for their sin. Go ahead and read the last two verses of this section in Numbers. Then the Lord said to Moses, make a fiery serpent and set it on a standard, and it shall come about that everyone who is bitten, when he looks at it, he shall live. And Moses made a bronze serpent and set it on the standard, and it came about that if a serpent bit any man, when he looked to the bronze serpent, he lived. If you look back in Numbers, I think it's chapter 2, what you see is that every tribe of the children of Israel had a standard, and that they were all laid out in a radius around the tabernacle, 12 of them, and it signaled where every tribe was to camp. And they couldn't have been too close to the tabernacle, because at the time they entered the promised land, there were over 600,000 men of war. When you figure one wife and two children, and you've got 2.5 million people there already. And it could have been more than that, depending on how many children the people have. So these standards had to be up high, didn't they? I mean, if they were 10 feet tall, like this little thing over here I've got on my screen, probably couldn't see it. But it had to be up high enough for everyone to see it. So God tells them tells Moses to put this standard up, this serpent up on a standard and raise it up. And everyone who looks at it shall live. Doesn't this seem like an odd thing? An odd cure? To look at the very thing that has harmed you, for the cure. Can you imagine that the children of Israel? Somebody got bit by one of the... You need to go look at the snake on the pole. What? Look at the snake on the pole? That doesn't make sense. I'm not going to look at the snake on the pole. I mean, I could see people saying that. You know, that's senseless. What has that to do with me being healed? Well, desperate people will do whatever it takes to get the problem resolved. And these people were desperate. They had been bitten and they were dying. And the thing that cured them was not that they looked at the pole, it's they did what God told them to do to have themselves cured. Desperate people do what they're told to do. Those who believed Moses went and looked at the serpent on the pole and lived, and those who didn't believe, which I doubt if there were any, didn't, and died from the serpent's sting. We all know what the story's about, don't we? I mean, we've studied the Bible enough to know that this is not really about a serpent on a pole, even though that's what we have in the Old Testament. It's about Jesus Christ and the cure for sin. And we're told this in John 3:14-16. And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up, that whoever believes may in him have eternal life. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. And we could also look over at John 12:32. And I, if I be lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to myself. And you think about that serpent on a standard, so that even those on the outskirts of the camp, if they were bitten, could see it, they would go to that to be healed. Jesus has been lifted up to draw all men to himself. And you might say, well, he's not drawing all men to himself. Not everyone's drawn to Jesus. Well, those who recognize that they've been bitten by sin and are dying are drawn to Jesus Christ. If they just will seek for God and find him. I'm going to go ahead and just read Colossians 2 here, and then we'll maybe read one other verse real quick. My time's well past gone. I said earlier, why would God have them look at the very thing that harmed them for the cure? Well, I think one thing we have to recognize is that what they were looking at was not a live serpent. They were looking at an ineffective serpent. Perhaps even a replica of a dead serpent that had lost its power. That's what they were looking at. And if the serpent is the law, then it seems to me that this passage speaks to that. And you, when you were dead in your transgressions and the uncircumcision of your flesh, he made you alive together with him, having forgiven us all our transgressions, having canceled out the certificate of debt consisting of decrees against us and which was hostile to us, and he has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross. God took the thing that killed us, the law that we could not hold ourselves up to, and he nailed it to the cross in the sacrifice of his Son, Jesus Christ, who became sin on our behalf as well. And for that reason, we can have salvation in him. And we can look back at 1 Corinthians 15:56. I probably should read the first part of that. O death, where is thy victory? The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law, and God has done away with it. I should have had a few more, expanded that verse out a little bit. You know, I suppose that somebody in that day and time could have said, you believe in serpent salvation. You believe that that serpent saves you. That would have been ludicrous. Those people didn't believe the serpent saved them. They believed that God saved them. But they believed that doing what God told them to do was intertwined with their salvation. It could not be separated. Jesus doesn't tell us to look at a serpent on a pole, but what he does tell us to do is to be baptized for the remission of our sins, to be baptized in water for the remission of our sins. God's just telling us what we need to do to come in contact with his salvation. They were saved by belief. They were saved by obedience. They were saved by grace. They were saved by doing what God told them to do. And that's the way we're saved today. We don't deserve it. We're sinners in need of salvation. If you're here this evening and you've recognized sin in your life and you have not made the decision to obey the gospel and be baptized for the remission of your sins, we will assist you in that at this time. If there's any other way we can help you, please come forward as we stand and sing the song of invitation.